Greetings, everyone. I'm here today on the Celtic Feminine podcast with a very special guest, Anthony Murphy. If you've been following my work or the podcast, of course, for a while, you know that I've been a little bit quieter in the last couple of years as far as online content. However, I've been more active in public speaking where I am located, not too far from the Quebec and Vermont border. But I'm glad to be back here with the podcast, and I'm glad to be continuing to contribute content where the streams of folklore, women's studies, ethnomusicology, and Celtic spirituality meet. And you can find out more on the CelticFeminine.com or by finding us on YouTube and the major podcasting hosting platforms out there, Apple, Spotify, etc. But today I am delighted to have Anthony Murphy with us. He is the curator of the Mythical Ireland podcast, which can be found on YouTube. Both the blog and the tour information can be found at mythicalireland.com. Anthony is the author of 9 books, including nonfiction and fiction books discussing ancient Ireland. He is the discoverer of Dronehenge, a late Neolithic henge near Newgrange, as well as 300 previously unrecorded monuments using Google Earth and Apple Maps. And he's taken on so many roles, such as an accomplished photographer, he's a tour guide, script writer and narrator, storyteller, musician and band leader, contributor to TV programs with National Geographic, History Channel, Discovery Science, Channel 4, BBC, RTE, and TG4. And he has hundreds of thousands of followers online. He has been the recipient of numerous awards and prizes for his work. And Anthony's main career has been as a journalist in the newspaper industry in the Drogheda Leader, Dundalk Democrat, and the Irish Farmers Journal, including such roles as reporter, graphic designer, and editor. So Anthony has so many accomplishments and has been involved with so many exciting projects, and that you'll want to take a look more at his comprehensive bio on his website. So, a happy belated St. Patrick's Day to you and a happy spring equinox, Anthony. Thank you so much. I'm so glad that you're here with us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you for the nice welcome and happy vernal equinox to the
Oh,
Northern Hemispherers.
that's it. Totally, exactly. I believe it was some time during the COVID years where I was searching on YouTube to get caught up on a lot of the Bridget's Day virtual events that were being offered since we weren't able to gather in person. And there are so many opportunities to celebrate online and at home. And I stumbled upon your podcast and your work. So you host the Mythical Ireland podcast. How did that originally start? And what was it like to start this podcast?
Well, I think you might be talking about Live Irish Myths, which was a live stream that began on the day that the Irish government announced the first lockdowns, which was in March of the year 2020, on the 12th of March specifically. On that very day, the government said, from tomorrow, all the schools are closed, nobody's to go to work, you know. And it was a very worrying time. And that evening, just around the time it was getting dark, I sat here and switched on a webcam and went live and started reading Irish myths and legends. And very quickly, over the following few evenings, a lot of people started gathering around virtually, people who are similarly locked into their homes or locked down, as it were, people who were similarly concerned about what was happening and looking for a safe space and looking for somewhere they could learn a little about, you know, the stories of the past and the myths and legends of Ireland. So, as of 2 days ago, we had episode number 271. But I should say that in the first months of the pandemic, the live stream was held every day at 8 o'clock in the evening time, Irish time, which corresponded to 3 p.m. in New York, or 12 noon in Seattle, or 12 noon in Los Angeles. And so I was doing it nonstop every day for 103 episodes, I think, before finally deciding to make it a weekly stream rather than a daily one, as life slowly started to get back to normal for many of us.
Ah, that sounds wonderful. There was such a flourish of people offering so many great things, and it was amazing that so many things stopped happening in person, but then could happen online, such as the arts. It's like music and poetry and storytelling and myths were right there for us when we really needed them. And I could understand that impulse of having something consistent every day, which was so wonderful. But before the pandemic, how did you first get involved with the with Irish myths and or interested in Irish myths and sacred sites?
Well, that all began just over 25 years ago in earnest in the very first month of the year 1999. So 25 years ago, 2 months ago, when I teamed up with Richard Moore, who's an artist here in Drogheda. Drogheda is the largest town in Ireland. And will probably be Ireland's next city because it's heading towards a population of 50,000. And
Wow.
we're very close, of course, to the great monuments of Bru na Bóinne. The world famous Newgrange monument is only literally 4 miles in that direction as the crow flies behind me. And so that proximity to the monumental landscape and the mythological landscape meant I had a natural interest anyway, as a sort of a journalistic and a curious, inquisitive type. I was interested in astronomy from a very young age, became fascinated by the night sky and the stars and all of the things to do with the sky. And so when I met Richard, he was looking to learn more about astronomy. And then he started telling me all the stories connected with the monuments. And I was just blown away because these were stories we hadn't learned in school. We'd been taught Virgil. And Homer, we had read the Iliad and the Aeneid, and we'd learned all about Odysseus, but we had learned scarce little about the myths and legends about our own home place, which it turned out after, I can say this, after years of study and years of interest, I can say that the Irish mythological material is equal to that of the classical world in terms of the volume of it, you know, the amount of it. So that's how it started in earnest. And then Mythical Ireland appeared on the internet just over 24 years ago on the 16th of March in the year 2000. So just over a year into our research, I came up with the idea that it would be good to create a website that would capture some of that information and some of the photography. And so Mythical Ireland was born, and there's a whole blog post about that that I posted a few days ago on the 24th birthday of the website. It's a curious thing because I didn't know anything about creating websites. I didn't know anything about HTML. I literally learned as I went along. I learned very quickly. It was a steep learning curve. So the original website was against a black background, and you know, dial-up internet and scanning photographic prints. This is before digital cameras. All I'll say is that there's a whole generation of young viewers and listeners to this podcast who will not know anything of the troubles of creating an online presence. A quarter of a century ago, they just won't know how difficult it was and how convenient and how easy it is these days. But that's how it all began back in 1999 when I met Richard, and then in 2000 when the website appeared.
Oh, that's fantastic. Ah, the days of HTML coding, you know? It was like
That do you know that so sound that the dial-up used to make when you connected your computer to the phone socket, and it went through this set of sounds. It sounded like your computer was communicating with a distant planet, a distant race of extraterrestrials somewhere way off on the other side of the galaxy. And after a moment, after about a minute of listening to different tones and squeals coming from there, you might get success, but sometimes the connection failed and you'd have to try again, and
Oh,
you couldn't try
yeah.
several times before it actually made it, you know.
Oh, it was tragic too. just having to try to reconnect all the time, Oh my goodness. So yeah, it was interesting. And I talked to Dolores Whelan when she was on the podcast about this, where I had this experience where I was in Galway, 2017, and I went to Charlie Burns and got some, it's a great bookstore there. I got a couple Irish spirituality books and things, and I went and walked and went to a restaurant, and it was a seafood restaurant. I was just kind of looking at my book, and the waiter just chatted me up and said, "Hey, what are you reading?" And I, said what I was, reading about Irish spirituality or whatever. And he kind of snickered, and I was like, what? Like, I don't know. He was kind of, it was kind of weird and awkward snicker kind of, and I didn't know exactly what it was, what was behind it, but she mentioned maybe he didn't really like, we're not, you weren't really raised with a knowledge of Celtic spirituality or Irish spirituality at all,
No.
so yeah, so it's different. And so your work is so valuable to bring this to light, and your recent podcast, of course, with about St. Patrick. So speaking of St. Patrick's Day and spring equinox, I'm curious if there's been any particular topics or stories that have been on your mind lately in relationship to St. Patrick's Day. So I find for me, sometimes there's some aspects about Bridget's Day, for instance, that I kind of become interested in that particular year and then bring that to anybody I'm talking to about St. Bridget. But did you find that was the case for St. Patrick's Day this year?
St. Patrick's Day, over recent years, and I'm really talking about the last decade probably, has become a challenging time from the point of view of the sort of untruths and misinformation that gets propagated, especially on the 17th of March, especially on that day. I have found on the Mythical Ireland social media, mostly talking about Facebook here. I don't have a huge following on X or Twitter, if you prefer. And it doesn't seem to be a problem on Instagram nearly as much, but on Facebook in particular, people just come along on St. Patrick's Day, people who've just don't contribute to the Facebook groups at any other time of the year, and drop in and start copying and pasting information about Patrick that some of it is just completely made up nonsense, you know? And so in recent years, what I've tried to do with Mythical Ireland on social media is to curate a learning space and a sort of a safe space, a place where people are valued, but a place where I have a fairly low tolerance for bullshit. You know, I'm sorry, but and I even though I'm quite open-minded and quite philosophical and quite spiritual in some of my own work. The important thing is that you've got to have read or you've got to have gone off into the landscape and learned this stuff firsthand. So there are so many different ideas. So the big difficulty with Patrick now for modern pagans in particular is the idea that he committed genocide against pagans when he arrived in Ireland. And what doesn't help there is that the story of Patrick, as it has been related by the hagiographers, is quite marvelous, to the point of being largely mythological. And so, when he lit the Paschal fire in the Boyne Valley in the 5th century, in 432 AD, at Easter, he did so in contravention of the High King of Tara, who said that whoever lit the fire should be killed because the punishment was death. Nobody should light the sacred fire before the High King first did so at Tara. But Patrick eventually overcame the challenge of the Druids and he made them fight against each other and half of them dropped dead and all the rest. And when he finally arrived at Tara the next day, which remember is the what you might call the political, the pre-Christian or pagan, and I don't use that word very much because the problem with the word pagan is it comes with all this baggage. When you see it used in a Christian context, of course, it's a pejorative word. It means anybody who doesn't subscribe to the Christian religion, and therefore these people are all in darkness. But the problem is that according to the story, according to the tripartite life of Patrick, 12,000 of the inhabitants of the area around Tara dropped dead as the result of God's anger, which was r aroused by the king wanting to kill St. Patrick. And of course, when you read that, you should never be taking that sort of thing literally. You know, that's clearly not a historical record of events. But we have a problem where people read certain things on the internet and get ideas into their heads. And so a challenge has been, as a non-Christian, someone who was raised in the Catholic faith, but who is now firmly agnostic, is to try to get people to see the middle way. You know, there's so much today, don't you know, on social media. There's so much, it's not discussion really, it's just, it descends into vitriolic debate where everything seems to be, it's either black or white. And in fact, as we often find in our own waking lives, much of what we encounter through our journey in life is actually grey. Much of what really happened in the past falls between one extreme and the other. But people tend to, on the internet, adopt an extreme viewpoint, a hard left, a hard right, or whatever it happens to be. It's black or it's white, but so much of it is actually grey. And so much of the story of Patrick is very grey, because I have repeatedly said, quoting somebody else who I can't remember who it was, but it was a scholar, that the known facts of St. Patrick's life could be written on the back of a postage stamp. But the mythological content of the description of what he did, the fable of Patrick, as it were, the folklore of Patrick would fill many, many volumes. What do we actually know about him? Very little. He left his own confessio, the confession of Patrick, in which he comes across as quite a humble man, not at all the fearsome religious warrior that we meet in the hagiographies. So I'm much more interested in Bridget, of course, as you know, and I know we're going to get talking about Bridget. For me, although Bridget has a very, very dogged attitude, which I admire greatly, she doesn't have the fire and brimstone stuff so much as Patrick. I think the church figures of the later centuries, and I'm talking about maybe around 1,000 years ago, the church figures wanted an icon, a patriarch of Christianity in Ireland, and they made that retrospectively for Patrick. I suspect that the original Patrick, without all of the baggage of that propaganda of the later church, might have been actually quite a sound guy, despite the fact he was trying to convert people. I suspect his conversions were much more gentle. They were much less vitriolic than the official biographies of his life would have us believe. And remember, they were written centuries after he had lived and died. So, as always, picking up on the tale very late in the day and imagining that certain things happened that probably never happened at all, you know.
It's interesting how even with Bridget, she's utilized in a particular way in order to, promote certain ideals, certain values at certain times, and it changes through history. So it's really interesting. And the same with Patrick, it sounds like. And yeah, it isn't very interesting about, trying to find that gray space, that nuanced space of being able to talk about these figures and talk about the mythology and utilize these stories and be able to really say what's really there without this hard line, one side or the other, and really just embrace things, with love. And like you were saying, have a safe space for people to explore, to learn. And I think it's wonderful. It's great work. Now, St. Patrick's Day, it happens around spring equinox. Do you think that there's a connection with St. Patrick and springtime? Do you think that there's any indication that there's a Christianization of the spring equinox? It's something I wonder about, but
Yeah.
as we see sometimes with other
I
holidays.
do. I do. One of the first things that Patrick, so this is mythological content.
Sure.
As I said, the known facts could be written on a very, very, very small piece of paper. The known provable facts. There's a lot of gray area facts, facts where we couldn't prove them, but we could make a substantial argument for them. That's not to say Patrick's life is entirely a fable, and I'm not trying to say that. Some people who are still a Catholic adherents get upset by that sort of statement, and I think they misunderstand me. I'm not trying to rubbish, or ins I'm not trying to insult you, and I'm not trying to rubbish your beliefs. I'm just pointing out the the alternatives, as it were.
Yeah.
But so one of the first things that Patrick does when he arrives in the Boyne Valley, according to mythological tradition, is he kills a serpent and dismembers it and throws it into the River Boyne. Now, I have absolutely no doubt, as I've written about this in several of my books, that is a borrowing, an appropriation of an earlier legend connected with the sun god, because the sun god, who is Dagda, associated with the building of the great monument of Newgrange, mythologically, we're talking mythologically here, we're not talking factually. We don't know. We think a community of farmers who arrived here around 6,000 years ago, built all those great monuments over a period of 1,000 years. The Dagda also killed a monster, the Mata, a great slow-moving or sluggish beast that came along and crawled along in the Boyne and drank up the Bo River Boyne until it became a dry river valley. Now, there are two versions as to how the Mata was killed. One says all the men of Ulster hacked it to pieces on a mysterious stone at Newgrange and threw it into the Boyne. And the other version, which is in Tochmarc Emer, the wooing of Emer in the Ulster cycle, that the Dagda clubbed, he hit this great underwater monster on the head with his club of anger. And when the monster was killed, all the water that had covered the land drained away, which is where this, so the very area that I'm situated in, which is called County Louth, we have counties that are based on older Anglo-Norman administrative areas, which are actually based on older clan territories. Area that we call Louth was then known, or formerly known, as Muirchevne, which means the plain covered by the sea, because of this mysterious sea that had covered the land in which this monster lived. So I've no doubt that that's just a Christian appropriation of a pagan or a pre-Christian myth, and that what we're supposed to see is Patrick taking on. Patrick is basically taking on the mantle, in a way, of the sun god, and that, of course, is not at all what the Christian scribes would have wanted for him, because talking about sun gods and sun deities immediately challenges the God of the Bible and Yahweh, the fearsome, angry, and jealous God of the Old Testament, who demands first and foremost in his commandments, the first commandment, which some people who are not all that religious think is thou shalt not kill. It's not actually. It's thou shalt have no other gods before me, because this God is particularly jealous. There's another aspect that I've written about in a very long, well, quite a long article on the Mythical Ireland website in the mythology section. It's called The Myths and Legends of St. Patrick. There's another fascinating aspect, which is if you consider that Patrick lit the Paschal fire at a place called Firth of Fir Féach, the graves of the men of Féach, and that is assumed to be the Hill of Slain, where the first conversion of a druid to a bishop happened, and he was Bishop Urk, the first Bishop of Slain, previously a druid of King Lara of Tara. So you think about Slain being covered, or this fire emanating from the hilltop of Slain in the 5th century, being viewed from the Hill of Tara from one direction, but also from the west, from the interior of a very special Neolithic chambered cairn or passage tomb, which we call Cairn T, which was called the Collyock's Cairn or the Hag's Cairn. at Sleavna Collier in the far northwestern corner of Meath, where I noticed 20 years ago, and the picture is in the article on the website. I noticed that if you crouch down in the end recess of that chamber, now that chamber is unfortunately no longer open to the public. In 2018, it was closed because of concerns that it was going to subside and collapse. But if you sit in there and crouch in the end recess and look out towards the distant horizon through the entrance of the passageway, you're looking directly at the Hill of Slain. And I thought, this is interesting. In the Neolithic, so more than 5,000 years ago, on the mornings of the equinoxes, we probably had people up there who built those monuments watching the sun rising and shining its light onto this panel of artwork, these engravings, which are picked out using stones, which appear to depict solar symbols, emblems of the sun wheels. So the sunlight is actually directly striking those. And at that time, the sun is rising over the Hill of Slain. And then 3,500 years later, along comes this new religion where this man lights a fire, very symbolic fire, representing the fire of Christianity. He does so so that he draws the ire of the King of Tara at the Hill of the King of Ireland at the Hill of Tara, the High King. But he also does so where he's directly overlooking the great monuments associated with the prehistoric deities, the Tuatha Dé Danann, who are said to have built the great monuments of Brú na Bóinne. You're looking down on them from Slane, and you're looking down at or across at Tara. And then in the distance in the west, you can't see it today because there's a lot of trees growing on the Hill of Slane. But without the trees there, you're looking also at Sleavna Collier, where this cairn looks towards the Hill of Slane. So we've got at equinox the fiery ball of the sun coming out of Slane, illuminating this chamber. And then 3,500 years later, you've got a man lighting a fire at around the time of equinox. And I have my suspicion that that is similarly why Slane, you know, well, there's several reasons for it, of course. But that may be one of them, that we're trying to commandeer something that's much more ancient and give it a Christian gloss, as it were, sugarcoat it, if you want. And that is not the only example of that, because the Christianity that develops in Ireland in the first couple of centuries after Patrick is a very insular Christianity, separated from the Roman world. The Roman Empire is already starting to decline by the time Patrick brings Christianity to Ireland. And in fact, a version, an isolated, as I say, insular version of Christianity that is so detached from the rest of Europe that we calculate Easter in a way that it can fall. Easter Sunday can fall on Passover, which is something the rest of Europe was saying, no, definitely, we want to separate the origins of Easter from Passover. So the way it was being calculated in Ireland, it could happen that Easter Sunday would fall on Passover. But the way it was being calculated in the rest of Europe, it couldn't. And eventually that was settled at the Synod of Whitby in the year 665 AD, when the Irish church leaders were basically told by everyone else, listen, you can't do that anymore, you know? And yet, what had arisen in Ireland was a Christianity based, not based on paganism, but which incorporated paganism into its feast days and its tenets. And there were no martyrs. Nobody was killed bringing Christianity into Ireland, which means that it wasn't resisted. And why was it not resisted? Because it was a blended, it was a religion that was blended with what beliefs were there already.
Gradually. Yeah, I find it fascinating that, you say the word Paschal, Paschal fire, in Hebrew, I believe it's Hebrew. For Passover, it's Pesach. So these words for Easter and Passover are very similar. In Italian, it's Buona Pasqua. Happy Easter. So you can see how there's a connection with these words. It's fascinating. And I really appreciate that you're illuminating this for us too. And so you've been around, you've been walking the land, going to so many of these different sites, and also taking a look with your camera, with your drone technology and things. And I just find it fantastic. And so, speaking about, walking the land and tours and things like that, I know that you've worked with the folks at Bridget's Way Tour. And could you tell us a little bit about Bridget's Way and what it is and what has been this your part in this project?
Well, it's a curious, it's just in case your viewers are suddenly thinking, wow, this is a bit of a sideways step from what we were just talking about. It isn't. It's actually directly related because it was that alignment of sites where Richard Moore, at the very beginning of our time together, about 25 years ago, he had been painting at the Hill of Tara, and he asked me a question, a very leading question, and it was like an intuitive question. It's like he knew somewhere inside him that there was an answer to this. He just didn't know what the answer was. And the question was, why, when Patrick lit the Paschal fire at Slane, why was he drawing the eyes of the king and his retinue away from Tara towards Slane? Well, it turns out that alignment, as it were, from Tara to Slane continues in both directions and intersects some very important sites. And we wrote about it in our book, Island of the Setting Sun, In Search of Ireland's Ancient Astronomers, which was published in 2008. And then it sold out very quickly in the space of a year. And then the publisher said, why don't we try to go for a revised and expanded version and we'll republish it? So it was republished in 2008. And most of the new material was about Bridget because I had sort of taken on to investigate this alignment across the landscape and found that it actually very, very precisely, if you draw a line on a map, or if you're using Google Earth, you're actually creating an arc because it follows the curvature of the Earth. It's not a straight line from one place to the other. It's like an arc just over the gradually curving Earth. But if you take a straight line from Tara, from the Mound of the Hostages, which is the oldest monument there, through the mound on the top of the Hill of Slane, there's an ancient mound there, definitely pre-Christian, possibly Neolithic, probably at least Iron Age, Bronze Age. And you take it through from one mound through the other, you go all the way to Fochart in the north of County Louth and to very precisely the well of St. Bridget at Fochart. And if you take it in the other direction, it passes through numerous other sites, such as the Barrow Cemetery on the hill of Mount Oriel in County Louth, and a very large moated mound site at Bow Park in County Meath, Thurstonstown. But it goes all the way then in the other direction to the Curragh, and of course they're the two places most strongly associated with Bridget because she was born at Fochart, according to the tradition of that locality, and she founded her monastery on the fringes of the Curragh. And of course the famous story is that she asked the King of Leinster if she could have some land upon which to graze her cattle, and he mockingly said, ha, 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 you can have as much land as your cloak will cover. And when she took off her cloak and laid it on the ground, it magically expanded and covered this area of several thousand acres, which is now the Curragh Plain. And it was on the fringes of that that she set up her monastery, the monastery of Kildare, where there is still to this day a very strong devotion to Bridget, but we might get to that. Anyway, so I wrote about this, and then I was talking about this in Dublin at a Bridget's Day event. Can't remember exactly the year, but it probably would have been 2008, 2009, 2010.
Oh, neat.
And in the audience were two very interested women, one of whom I knew quite well, Dolores Whelan, who was a guest on your podcast. And the other was Karen Ward. I'm not sure if Karen has been a guest on your
She has
podcast.
also, yes.
Well, there you go. Not surprised. And so they decided sometime, either that day or sometime afterwards, they decided, well, that sounds like a pilgrim route. Let's. They founded a pilgrimage based on that route from Fochart to Kildare. Now, there's two things about that that are lovely. One is the fact that it's not a Catholic slash dyed in the wool Christian pilgrimage. It's for anybody, whether you have religious belief or none, whether like me you're agnostic or maybe you're atheistic or maybe you're a Hindu. It doesn't matter because pilgrimage at the end of the day shouldn't be about exclusion. It should be about inclusion. The other beautiful thing is in the first year of the pilgrimage, which was 2013, 11 years ago now, well, 11 years ago in the summer, We were crossing Sally Cox's land at Lisnawillie on the western fringes of Dundalk, which is another large town in County Louth. And the landowner there, Sally Cox, brought my attention, and Dolores, I think, as well, brought my attention to the fact that a historian had written, a historian based in that area, had written about a pilgrim route connecting Fochart with Kildare. That this was a historic pilgrim pathway that led from Fochart north of Dundalk to Kildare, and at some point in the past had been walked by adherents or followers of Bridget, as it were. And I thought that was just fantastic because I didn't know anything about that when I intuitively followed up Richard's question, which was, why did the king? Why was the king's eye, why were the king's eyes being drawn towards Slane? But the interesting thing about that alignment is we have a mound at Slane where there is a crossover point of two very strong long distance alignments, one of them associated with the journey of St. Patrick westwards. So he arrives at the Boyne, mouth of the Boyne, he goes to Slane, lights the Paschal fire, and at some point he ends up on the mountain in the west in Mayo called Crochan Aigle, the Mountain of the Eagles, which later becomes known as Croagh Patric, the reek associated with Patrick because he fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. And while he was there, he was attacked by various accounts, say a demon birds, serpents, or a giant serpent called the Cara, which he threw into a nearby lake and it died. And that lake has become known as Loch Cara. And so this is another, I believe, continuation of that solar father myth. But so we've got Slane where the Paschal fire was lit with this very strong equinox pathway of Patrick leading directly through it. And almost in the opposite direction, or almost at 90 degrees to it, but not quite, in a north-south sort of motion, is this Bridget line passing from Fort to Kildare, which is quite incredible. It's like there is a and this is, of course, all esoteric. What I'm talking about now is not provable in any way, but it's almost as if the mound of Slane has this. It marks a very significant crossing point of two different, very different types of energy. The energy of the Christian patriarch, who takes on the mantle of the ancient sun deity, and the mantle of the feminine deity. Who is very singular, who's very independent, who's like an icon of feminism in a way, because Bridget was very, very strong when it came to dealing with the men. Those who were courting after her were left in no uncertain, well, they were left knowing fully that she wasn't going to have anything to do with them because she was strong enough to be able to gouge out one of her eyes to make herself ugly. Until such time as the man stopped showing interest in her, where she would find her way to the nearest well and heal herself of her blemish. She had this extraordinary power. And of course, many of the wells associated with Bridget, you will find are associated with healing the sight and problems with the eyes and problems with the sight, which is amazing. So that's where the Bridget's Way alignment actually emanates from. It emanates from the writing that and the investigation that Richard and I had done all the way back, beginning in the early 2000s and culminating in 2008 with the writing of that new chapter, and then the talk in Dublin at which Karen and Dolores were present, you know.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And it must have been really meaningful and special for you. What was maybe the most meaningful part of being a part of that whole tour and the discovery of that alignment?
It touched on me very personally, actually. So Richard and I, on our way to making discoveries and, you know, finding out all these fascinating things, we had encountered several sort of significant well, I suppose you could call them coincidences, but I would call it synchronicity, you know. Very, very, very major and highly unlikely things were happening. That one of the things that happened around that time, which gave me, as an agnostic, challenged any notion that I might have had that, you know, everything was logical and everything was empirical and everything could be proved by science. It really knocked that on the head for me because there are things. I think that you're, by the way, I think that your religious and spiritual views should be informed by your experiences. Problem with religion is other people telling you what to do and how to behave and what to
Yes.
believe in. Spirituality, of course, is what you learn yourself, what you intuit yourself, what you pick up as you go along. So spirituality is what's personal to you. And despite the onslaught of very organized religion in Ireland over a millennium and a half, many people actually did remain intensely spiritual in a way that would have annoyed the Catholic Church had they known about it. But of course, a lot of people kept that to themselves. So anyway, I worked for a time as the editor of the Dundalk Democrat. And Dundalk is a town that rivals with Drogheda, the two towns. Drogheda, I was born and bred in. I love the place. As I said, it's going to be Ireland's next city. Drogheda and Dundalk had this intense rivalry, you know, over the years. Similar sized towns, both based in a very small county, the smallest county in Ireland. And yet, I have relatives in Dundalk on my father's side because his family had come from Dundalk. So I felt I had ties with the place. Anyway, I was one day while I was working there, I was investigating this alignment on Google Earth at lunchtime in work in Dundalk when I discovered that if you know, because Google Earth is so very helpful with these in terms of defining, you know, exact places and exact crossover points, I found that the alignment, the Bridget's Way alignment from Fochart to Kildare, crossed directly through the property in Bridge Street in Dundalk, and even the name of the street, Bridge, sounds like Bridget. It crossed directly through the property where my grandmother, my father's mother, was brought. She was raised in an orphanage for a number of years because her mother had died when she was an infant. And her father, who was a cobbler, a repairer of shoes, had a business in Dundalk on Bridge Street and went to the convent school where she was basically ensconced and said, "You're going to come home and work for me." And her name was Bridget. And so that was the clearest. That day will stand out as being the day when I realized that, and I've said it numerous times afterwards, that, you know, Bridget. My relationship with Bridget, anyway, is such that she came along and started tapping me on the shoulder and saying, "Here, listen, you need to pay attention to this. Here, look at this, look at this, look at this." And eventually, if I wasn't listening, she'd tap me harder and harder, you know. And eventually, sort of in a non-violent way, be it like a slap in the face or throw a bucket of water over you or hit you with something harder to make you listen. So that very day, when I had discovered that the alignment crossed through. By the way, that property is still standing in Dundalk, even though it's derelict. The property where my great grandfather had run his cobblers, and where my grandmother had gone as, I don't know, a 10-year-old or maybe she was 12 to work with him before she eventually met my grandfather and they moved to Drogheda, was still standing. And that very day, I'll never forget it. On the way home from work, I had only left work and I was in the car driving home to Drogheda and the phone rang and it was a good friend of mine, a man called Sean Gilmartin. Now, Sean is deceased now, but Sean spent, he was a, believe it or not, in his day job was as a telecom engineer working with microwave masts, you
Well.
know, and mobile phone technology. But his great passion in life was unearthing all the folklore of Ireland and talking to people in all different places around the countryside and getting the stories from them. And he rang me and said, "I said, you know, I said, hey, Sean, how's it going?" He said, "How are you doing, Anthony? I'm just letting you know." He said, I'm I'm giving a talk next week in Balbriggan Library, and I thought you might be interested in the subject, and that you maybe you might want to come along. And I said, "Oh, sounds interesting. Yeah, no problem. What's it about?" He said, "St. Bridget." And at that moment, I nearly crashed the car because I said it to him. I said, "Sean, you will not believe what I've just found out today," and told him about the coincidence of, the things he was telling me at that moment on that day. And so yeah, when you ask how, about personal connections, I don't think it gets much more personal than that. And
Yeah,
that's
for
where
sure.
I have to be careful, because sometimes I know that I know that I can seem like a bit of a gatekeeper in terms of, I want people to know the stories of Ireland, but I want them to know the genuine ones, not the sort of nonsense that gets copied and pasted on the internet without any reference to sources. And yet, at the same time, here's this guy who's acknowledged vast or huge synchronicities that happen, and acknowledged that there's a sort of a hidden helping source in some of his work.
Yeah.
And so I have to acknowledge that, and I think it's possible to do both, of course, but it's interesting, it's interesting to say the least.
Yeah.
It challenges the extent of one's agnosticism, just put it that way,
That's right. When you have the agnosticism and then you have this awe and wonder, and it's like, how do you make sense of it all, you know? And it's like you kind of have,
Well, I
yeah,
think that
what do you think?
I think that life has a way, if you are open to it, of course, and that doesn't mean if you're naive,
Right.
but if you're open to it, life has a funny way of showing you things.
Yeah.
I've just repeatedly found that incredible synchronicities and coincidences that have accompanied this journey, which at all times seem like some sort of affirmation from some source outside of me
Yeah.
that says, "Yeah, you're on the right path there, buddy. Keep going," rather than something that threatens and seems like, no, something that steers you away from it all. It's all very affirming. So when
Yeah.
Sean rang that day and said, "I'm giving a talk about St. Bridget, I thought you'd be interested," I was kind of looking around and saying,
Like
"Oh, you're having a laugh now, Bridget. You really have me now. You've caught me. You have my full and undivided attention,
it's just fantastic. Maybe you found that even like doing this work, it brings up, there's almost like intuitive things that kind of come out. I don't know if like the with the synchronicities, but sort of you kind of get a sense about people and the landscape and oh, maybe I should go over here and take a look at this on Google Earth, and then you kind of come across something, you know. I've you were mentioning about your family history. I've been interested in family history as myself. I have some Irish heritage. I mostly have been grown up with my Italian heritage right there and cultural traditions and things like that. But doing some research, and I still have to do more on the Irish side, but finding that, you know, there are so many synchronicities for me with finding Bridget, and it's like she revealed herself to me, little me here in the United States. I live in Canada now, but it was amazing to have that happen in about 2005. But then, you know, doing family history research and finding there was an ancestor I had named Bridget Kennedy, Biddy Kennedy, who got married in Kildare, which is very interesting with, you know, I'm like, how is this happening? This, you know, it's pretty wild, and I have to really get into it a bit more, you know. You know, speaking about Bridget, and we've covered St. Patrick's Day, and then with Bridget's Day on February 1st in Imbolc. You know, I loved your podcast this year about it. And you know, you personally mentioned a disclaimer about in bulk and how, like you're saying, that the information about celebrating in bulk can be, written on a postage stamp or written on a half of a sheet of paper or something like that. Could you tell us about the earliest documentation about in bulk and what you often say to your audiences during that time?
So if you were to read some of the material that's posted on social media in particular and on websites at In Bulk about the celebration of In Bulk, you'd say to yourself, oh, geez, that sounds like a very rich tradition going back into the distant past, and isn't it fantastic? But actually, it is very poorly attested in the manuscripts. And when I, of course, say the manuscripts, I'm referring to the 300 or so existing manuscripts. There's probably many more that are untranslated, but this is material where the content of which, whether it be mythological, whether it be law tracts, whether it be genealogies or Dinshanaka's material about place names and sagas and stories, it is very poorly attested, as in Imbolc. Imbolc's first mention anywhere is in the 9th century, the late 9th century, Sanas Cormac, which a lot of Irish scholars and people interested in mythology will know as Cormac's Glossary. Cormac was a high king of Cashel in the south of the country, but he was also a bishop. Talk about no separation of powers, high king and a bishop. And it shows you, I think, how close some of the scribes and the holy men were to the kings. They kind of had a symbiotic relationship. One relied on the other. Basically, the early monasteries relied on the kings for their land, and the ability to do what they did. And in return, they were asked to preserve the stories and the genealogies of the king and their associated clans and families. So that's the first mention. And it's Oi Melig, Yo's milk, or Ewe's milk. The U in Ireland, most farmers pronounce that EWE. Most farmers in Ireland pronounce that yo,
Yo.
but we most of us heathen unfarming types would non-farming types would call it you. So Cormac attempts to say that Oi Melig, which is related phonetically, as it were, to Imbolc, is the springtide feast where the yo's milk first comes in for the coming lambing. And that's it. It's very terse. Cormac's Glossary is a compendium of about, I think it's around 1600 terms. A lot of them are proper nouns, place names, and personal names. It's been described by some scholars as a what is it? A pseudo etymological database where Cormac composed it and imagined that certain things meant certain things. By the way, it's also Cormac's Glossary that gave rise to the notion that Brigid's name means fiery arrow, Bro Haggit. Haggit is the Lennonite version of Sagitt, which is Irish for arrow, but it's based on Latin, Sagitta. So the linguists have said we can dismiss that one. That is definitely a pseudo etymology. And yet you've got, again, when it comes to Imbolc, you get all sorts of things. Brigid's name means fiery arrow. And Imbolc was the time of year when the ewes milk came in. Now, we're not saying that that's nonsense, but if you read anything else, it's likely to have been added by somebody along the way, because there's a very, very, very limited amount of material about Imbolc. Now, if you were to talk about one of the other great festivals of the Irish year, the two or three largest ones would be Bealtaine, Lunasa, and Samhain. Samhain is the one, if any of your listeners are confused, you may have heard that pronounced Samhain or something similar.
I don't
I'm an
see
Irish man. I was taught to speak Irish in school. It's Samhain. It's not
it.
pronounced Samhain, but or Beltane for Bealtaine. But Lunasa is the one with the greatest attestation, because it continued. It looks like it continued for many, many, many centuries of Irish history. And we have a huge number of Lunasa celebration sites around the country, where Lunasa was celebrated on the last Sunday in July, according to the later Christian or Gregorian calendar, but was probably tied with the original celebration of the harvest festival from prehistoric times in August. In bulk, we have very, very little to say about. So if you read a very comprehensive article about Imbolc and how it is celebrated and the various rites and rituals associated with it, ask the author for the sources. Because
Exactly.
they're likely to be few and far between. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, we can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. So that is a deficiency. The deficiency is that for centuries and centuries, probably since deep prehistory, until the churchmen arrived and began to write things down, the Irish people were an oral culture. Everything of importance was propagated orally. We sang and we spoke and we made poetry. We didn't write. We resisted writing. In fact, it is definitely not an exaggeration to say that a majority of Irish people did not learn to read and write until the 20th century. That is not an exaggeration.
And I can believe it.
So we resisted, we being the Irish, we resisted writing things. So there's a deficiency there. There is a deficiency in that there's a paucity of descriptions about Imbolc in the manuscripts. And yet, into modern folklore, there's this huge survival of Lunasa rites and rituals and festivities. Does that mean that Imbolc was of less importance? It doesn't. Possibly what happened was its importance waned over the years with all of the changes that came. But yes, it coincides with what we might call a cross-quarter date. So the halfway point measured in days between winter solstice, which we absolutely know was a prehistoric date of importance because it's marked by a number of alignments of Neolithic sites here in the Boyne Valley, the halfway point between then and today, and of course today is Vernal equinox. So I don't know when this podcast will be published, but I think
Soon.
you mentioned it already. We're recording it on the 20th of March.
Yes.
Today is the vernal equinox. Today is the day upon which, astronomically, what is the definition of vernal equinox? Is actually the scientific explanation is that is the day on which the sun crosses the celestial equator on its journey from south of the equator to north of the equator. So from here on in the northern hemisphere, the days are longer than the nights, and in the southern hemisphere, the nights are longer than the days. So the halfway point between winter solstice and spring equinox is approximately Bridget's Day, but it's not because Imbolc never falls that early. Imbolc is
True.
generally the fourth or the 5th of February. If you actually count the number of days between the two and divide it in the middle, you'll find. But you see, the Gregorian calendar has an awful habit of taking older celebrations and arbitrarily giving them a date. I mean, the 21st of December, if you think about it, as winter solstice, is effectively a new year. You know, it's a New Year's Day or New Year's Eve, as it were. The rising sun on the day of the standstill, when the sun is going to swap or switch its position, it's going to start returning northwards, you know. And then the
Yeah.
equinox, which we said earlier, was marked at Cairn T looking at Slane. So we know that, or we're pretty sure that was an important date in the prehistoric calendar. And then Imbolc or Oimelg, as Cormac's refers to it in his glossary, approximately in the modern Gregorian calendar, the 1st of February is approximately around the time of Imbolc.
Yeah. It's interesting. And I'm wondering if you know about any celebrations that have been documented, within the last 500 years or something like that. That, oh, yes, we are in this town and we're celebrating this particular feast.
No, the celebrations in early February that we find in folk, in the detail of folklore, are all connected with Bridget, and they're all connected with Saint Bridget.
Okay.
And this is the part that some, and I'm not generalizing because it's only some, because I know lots of modern pagans, and they're not all biased and they're not all mad, but some of them are quite crazy. But what people should understand is They probably saw in Bridget something, as I do, by the way, something that moves, extends beyond the boundaries of religion. This is one of the wonderful things about Bridget. And I can't say the same about Patrick. For me, Bridget is not bound by any specific religion. Yes, she became a very powerful, or very, not even a powerful, she became an icon. She became a matriarchal figure for the Irish. And of course, she was known as Muireann na n-Éill, the Mary of the Irish. But there's something about her and her stories and her very essence that gives her this broader, more universal appeal that says, yes, I am Catholic, but if you want, I'm not Catholic. I don't have to be labeled. In much the same way, by the way, as she said very clearly in her lifetime, I don't have to be married. I don't have to be defined by who I'm married to, which you may or may not know if you know anything about the social history of Ireland and the political and religious history of Ireland. And still, to an extent, can be this to this day, that we only have to go back a generation or two to when my wife, for instance, would have been referred to as Mrs. Anthony Murphy. You know that the woman's identity was exactly as the church defined it. You're a homemaker, you're in the home, and you're going to have children, and this is what your role is, and your role is to support the man. And I think that that is one of the wonderful things about Bridget. She can be absolutely at once for you, if that is your belief. She can be wholly Christian, and she can be a very, very Catholic icon. But at the same time, on the Bridget's way, over the years, you will have found, walking side by side, people who are devout Catholics, devout Christians, and people who are atheists or pagans or whatever. And there's no falling out between them. And I actually think that, you know, by and large, these people come to respect each other's viewpoints about Bridget. I think she's unifying rather than dividing. And I think that's the thing about Patrick that makes him different. I think he divides. He divides and conquers. And he certainly mythologically, if you look at some of what, you know, he made one of the druids at the Hill of Slain. He made one of the druids go up into the air and fall back down and dash his brains on the rocks. You know, it's a very horrible way
Doesn't
to.
sound so unifying.
Do you know what I mean, right? Bridget, much less so, and Bridget and her nuns, of course, are famed as kindling the eternal flame in Kildare. There's even a feature there in the churchyard that is described as being the fire pit, that she tended a flame. And you know, the pilgrims on the Bridget's Way, they carry the flame in the lantern, you know. And there is an order there of Brigidine sisters in Kildare who built a monastery that was entirely paid for by the people of that area. They fundraised. They raised, I think it was several hundred thousand. And those sisters welcome the likes of me and every footsore, weary pilgrim who happens to knock their door. It doesn't matter. They don't open the door and ask you, are you Catholic? You know, and if you're not, you're not welcome. It's not like that at all. Because of that universal aspect of the appeal of Bridget, because she is what you want her to be in a way, that she just seems to defy all boundaries and all attempts to either describe her, and by describing her, to cage her in some way. She's a very, very powerful figure, you know, and a very, as I say, a unifying one as well, I believe, you know. Perhaps I've said too much, but I
No,
didn't
it's
know
totally
if I labored
right.
the point, but.
And yeah, very unifying. And that's what I found when I first, had my own synchronicities with her. I started reading about her in the early days of, it was 2005, but still, it wasn't like today where you can order pretty much anything on Amazon. These days, like to understand more about Bridget, I went and, I did some searching and I found some books from, a Bridgetian sister, Rita Minnan, and Father Shona Dunn, the late Shona Dunn, who's at the Glenstall Abbey. And I was just like, wow, this is great. I'm going to order books from Ireland. And I was very excited and things like that. And, but I was nervous too, because, I was raised Catholic, but I also felt, that lack of unifying inclusion that we're talking about here, that not everybody was included, even though Catholic is supposed to mean universal. But I read their words and Rita Minnan's guidebook, and it just felt so loving and so inclusive, and that they had their whole position was in the right aspect, caring for the earth, caring for each other, providing for the I did a talk just recently for February 1st about the generosity of Bridget, and also about the Bridgetine sisters, about their hospitality and things like that. So it's a beautiful thing, and that's what's wonderful, the unifying feature that I can actually talk about Bridget, even though it seems a little bit of a, to some people, like a strange kind of a nerdy little thing I do or talk about or whatever. But I can talk to a variety of different people about her, and people start to understand and things like that. Whether it's Catholic or pagan, earth-centered on some sort, or people who are interested in travel or Ireland and beautiful sites and things like that.
Well,
So.
another of the things that's really interesting about Cormac's glossary is the fact that when he mentions Bridget, he only talks about the pre-Christian Bridget. He only talks about the poetess, the daughter of the Dagda, who was a matron, as it were. I was going to say a patron, but a patron, as a, if you like, a patron of the poets and the smiths and the healers. Now, this is strange for a 9th-century churchman to completely fail to talk about the Christian Bridget, who by that time had lived several centuries previously. Now, I don't fully understand it, but I'm guessing that there's some political interplay there between Kildare and Cashel, of course, as two power centres vying for each other, in much the same way as Armagh was successful in making Patrick the supreme church patriarch of Ireland at the expense of Bridget, by the way. And of course, the story there is that they met, and Bridget was a little bit. What's the word? She was a little bit less forthright in maintaining her independence with Patrick than she was with the other men who she encountered, which
Is it
made.
true that she was a young girl when, if she would have met him, like maybe she would be 7 years old or something like that, with
Yeah, I
the
think so.
dates.
I think so. I can't remember exactly. And this is one of the amazing things, or one of the daunting things about Irish myth and tradition, is that there's so much material that you can be reading, as I have done for 25 years, a quarter of a century, and still not know, and still be doubtful about things, and still have to say, look, I'm going to have to come back to you on that question. The
It's
other
so
thing about
true.
Bridget that's fascinating, remember, is that she was born at the threshold of a house. That's very important. Why is that important? Like I said earlier, Bridget is neither black nor white, bright nor dark, cold or dry, inside or out, above, below. Bridget is threshold. She's always between. She's between the extremes. And I believe that is where we see her most powerful aspect, between the extremes.
She said one parent was pagan and one parent was Christian, and so many different and that's what Rita Minnan talks about in her guidebook, and she draws from quotes from other sources too, that said that she's just provides a lot of wisdom with the different light and dark and different various
Yeah,
dichotomies.
it's an interesting one, that Also, and it's an extension of the subject that we've been broadly discussing from the very beginning of our conversation. It's interesting that you've got Bridget and Patrick Wright, who are two figures that are either very divisive or very unifying for modern pagans. On the one hand, you've got a lot of modern pagans who just have absolutely no respect for Patrick. They think he was a mass murderer, and some of them are quite vitriolic. There's barely concealed contempt and hatred for him, and yet they worship this figure. And I'm generalizing again, and I'm not trying to generalize him. There's a certain number of people who will, on the one hand, loathe Patrick and loathe Bridget without acknowledging that Bridget has aspects that make her both pagan and Christian. And I think, to be honest, I think if you can tolerate that, if you can live with that aspect of Bridget, and here's the threshold again, paganism, Catholicism, if you can live with that aspect of Bridget, then I believe you'd be very comfortable with her. And I would like to think that, even though I'm not a religious person, I'm a spiritual person, I would like to think that represents the best facet of humanity. The facet that says, look, let's not hate, and going back to the core messages of Christianity, which get lost in the vitriol and the debate about what the 20th century church did and the history of the church as a political body. Forget about all of that. If you just look at the core message of Bridget's life, the stuff about tending to the sick and the lowest, those least able to help themselves, minding cattle and the simple farming, the agrarian duties of the community. First and foremost, and then go to the very core messages of Christianity, which are the Beatitudes and the things that Jesus taught us about, love thine enemy and turn the cheek and all that stuff. Forget about all the fire and brimstone stuff. But unfortunately, there's a certain coterie, and quite a significant coterie of people who call themselves religious, but who like to hold on to the angry Yahweh Old Testament God type of energy, instead of looking for the sort of icons that would lead us to a newer, brighter, and more secure future as a human race, where we're tolerant of belief because that belief isn't so black and white. It isn't so eschatological. I mean, it strikes me that so much of, the modern church is absolutely possessed with the idea of the end of the world. And of course, you have modern religious groups who so fervently believe that we live in the end times. But it actually figures throughout the history of Christianity in Ireland, there are figures who believed they were living in the end times. Let's forget about the end times. Can we start envisioning a planet that will go on and on and on for our descendants and for the benefit of our descendants, if we just learn in this life to just listen to a few of the key messages of religion without having to cut people's heads off and throw stones at each other and go to war over these things. And I believe that Bridget provides a nice exemplar in that regard.
Exactly. And from your In Bulk podcast, I loved how you were, describing, there's so many stories of Bridget that you're like straight from the Jesus playbook, basically, because she's, performing these miracles and, producing food for people and taking care of the sick and the poor and, everything. So it's a beautiful story. It's a beautiful to be reminded of, and, the scarcity mindset we should get away from, that we're, the end times and everything. And there's a lot of wisdom about, like a lot of in the Irish, some symbolism with the circles and the everlasting, kind of, just, things go on and on and on. And it's a beautiful wisdom tradition, which I love. And with the Bridget's Way pilgrimage, speaking of just, this beautiful Celtic or Irish wisdom, Dolores Whelan, for instance, and along the tour, I believe there are songs that are sung. Is that right? That there are songs that are shared and things like that.
Yes, there are. Can I specifically remember them? Not really. I do remember that one of the things that I remember is that there was a great sort of feeling of joyful participation. I have to f forgive my dog. He's we call him the second doorbell. When somebody rings the doorbell, he starts barking. What struck me about it was the extent of the joyful participation in it all. I am old enough, I'll be 50 this week. I'm old enough to
Happy
remember,
birthday.
I know, right? A half century, 50 journeys around the sun. I'm old enough to remember when Ireland was a mostly devout Catholic country. When I was a young boy, in my first, certainly in the first decade of my life, and maybe a little bit more. I'm old enough to remember the s huge number of processions, religious processions that were held in my hometown throughout the year. Corpus Christi, which is one that isn't held anymore, and Good Friday procession, and all of the others. And I remember playing music in one or two processions with the brass band. And I remember how solemn it was, and I remember how it was the opposite of uplifting. It felt like, I'm sorry, and I don't want to denigrate, because I know there's plenty of people who still believe, and plenty of people who are still devout Christians, and this is not meant to hurt their feelings, but it felt to me as if, is it, Jesus mentioned something in the Bible about the vain repetitions of the heathen. It's just over and over again, and the rosary is being said, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee, blah, blah, blah. People are mumbling, and it all just it falls into this monotone sort of drone, It's just this, and it feels as if there's no energy in it. There's no positive energy in it. It feels the same could be said for the Catholic Mass. I attended enough of those as a youngster to remember sitting on a hard bench in a cold church, listening sometimes to a priest who wasn't blessed with the best voice in the world, literally mumbling from the altar, and the answer coming from the pews, and all the time feeling that, what are we doing here? This feels like you could actually feel in the air. The air was thick with some sort of oppression, Go on a pilgrimage with the Bridget's Way pilgrims, and you hear the songs being sung and the poetry and just the spontaneous things that happen. Won't talk about the day a load of people stripped off and swam in the canal, but the spontaneity of it and the joy of that. And it struck me that that is okay. This is not hedonism, by the way, because hedonism would be just going to a rock concert and taking drugs and having a few cans. This felt like a much, this felt like the sort of religion that if I had grown up with it, I probably wouldn't have given it up, to be honest. Whereas as an agnostic, the religion that I grew up, and the main reason I, apart from the fact that I felt I was speaking into an echo chamber, I couldn't communicate with the God of the Bible. He's a figure who's just far too aloof and far too brooding and threatening and jealous and all the rest. But there was something about the Bridget Way pilgrimages that felt it was religious and yet non-religious. But you felt like you were enjoying something joyful. I once attended, again, for musical reasons, not for religious reasons, I once attended in Drogheda a church service in one of these modern churches where the participants were, well, the pastor was a man of African origin. And the joy of the participation that day. And again, I found myself saying, wow, if only I had grown up in this kind of church, where we were joyful about celebrating what we believed rather than feeling quite miserable, which I believe is exactly where the church wanted Irish people to be in the 20th century.
Yeah.
Walking along through these lush fields on scenic routes through the wilderness, well, not wilderness, but you know what I mean, along the canals and of County Kildare, with these lovely people singing songs and just everybody just, you know, being in such, that felt closer to a true uplifting religious experience than pretty much anything else, you know.
Right. It's similar to what happens, for Bridget's Eve in Kildare, or maybe some of the other, there, I'm sure, are other processions that go on. But have you been to that one on Bridget's Eve in Kildare?
I regret to say that I haven't. But then
Ah.
I suppose one of the things about my journey is that I was very busy in my career.
Yeah.
I was working in newspapers for 31 years, and I've given, well, I haven't given it up completely, but I'm working for myself as Mythical Ireland now.
Sure.
And also we have five kids, so we were busy between work and home life. Life was extremely busy, so I often didn't get a chance to do the things.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping now, in the coming years, if I'm given the time, to
Yeah.
maybe enjoy such things, you know.
Right. So that's what's the beautiful thing. Like you were mentioning this, the pilgrimage, the songs and the joy and that. So that's basically what happens on, it's very meaningful. So it's without the oppression. Like I think we can be solemn, and it be very meaningful and awe-inspired rather than, kind of really, oppressive and sad and things like that. And that's what, when I met the sisters there, in Kildare, it was just, really very special, and they bring a very special energy to things. And it just feels like they've reinvigorated just the that spiritual expression. And so that kind of take that joyful and also awe-inspiring kind of candlelit walk, takes the place of this sort of the oppressive procession that you're discussing. Processions in general, as well as the music that goes along with it, and that was part of my master's degree thesis work when I was at the University of Limerick. That it's been interesting to me, but I've been taking a look at like Italian processions, for instance. And that has fascinated me as well. And then, of course, the place of brass bands and things like that. Do you find yourself ever at a moment where there is an inspired moment when you're in these processions, or does it usually always feel oppressive?
Well, I haven't participated in one for many, many years, but
Right.
I know that we would play music at some church events. We would, you know, we would still have a mass for our deceased members once a year, even though, well, I'd say a good deal of the people in the band are non-religious or secular, if you like. But
Sure.
we play some very religious music, you know.
Yeah.
We play some modern compositions or modern arrangements of some traditional Christian hymn tunes that are very moving, actually. So it's not like it's devoid of feeling. It's not like that at all. But I still do think that we should. I think that the best life lived is the life where what Joseph Campbell calls joyful participation in the sorrows of life, because life has sorrows in it. You know, life has comings and goings and illnesses and bereavements and accidents, and you know, sometimes we're hoping something happens and it doesn't happen and we get disappointed, and sometimes people get depressed and, you know, all of that. But to be able to still get up in the morning time and to face into the day with a feeling of, yeah, you know, I really feel privileged and blessed to to use a religious term, blessed,
Yeah.
feel fortunate to do the things that I'm very conscious of that myself, to feel blessed and fortunate and privileged to be able to do the things that I do, and to face into that with a feeling of gratitude and an uplifting sense that, yeah, look, as long as I'm able to do this, I think I should maintain an optimistic air about me rather than
That's it.
no.
That's beautiful. And just thinking about, just your outlook on, well, what you just shared, your outlook of life, and then also how it connects with sort of these newer almost traditions, and then all of your work with writing about these sacred sites and Irish myths and awesome like discoveries that you've made and things like that. You write, it seems like you're almost like prolific now. There's so many, it seems like it's just emerging from you, this information that you want to get out to the public and put down on paper so that people can appreciate it and everything and draw from it. What inspires you to continue to write?
Well, I just find it all intensely interesting, first and
Yeah.
foremost. I mean, I love it. I have a clear love for it. And after 25 years of research and reading and visiting places and all of the things that I've done, I still feel completely immersed in it. And I don't feel for a moment that it's ever going to get boring or it's ever going to that river's ever going to run dry, you know.
Yeah.
I'm working currently on my 10th book, which is the book about Fornax, which is a very special Neolithic monument. And there's no book about Fornax, so redressing an imbalance as well. But it may interest you that I actually have two completed books written over the past few years. I have two books sitting there that haven't been published yet, and I just
Oh, wow.
figure out a route to publication. One of them is larger than anything else I've ever written. It's 132,000 words.
Ah, wow.
Yeah, I know. So speaking of like a wellspring, so it's a great privilege, but at the same time, it's been difficult. It's been a challenge to try and make a living from it, which would be the ideal thing, because if I could make a living from it, it means I could just devote my entire time to, research and reading and writing, instead of having to also work to take me away from it all. But slowly getting there. But there's a great intrigue in it. It's lovely to be immersed in mystery, of course, to be looking at the past and to be figuring out, the aspects of that past that may not be obvious by reading textbooks and by reading academic works, which is where the slightly esoteric and intuitive side of my own investigation helps enormously. It's just to have that open-mindedness and that broad horizon, never and never to make assumptions about what you're doing. But I mean, it's who I mean, don't they say that the ideal life is one where your job is also the thing that is your great passion in life, and that if your job is your passion, you never feel like you're working.
That's it.
And so that's me in a nutshell. Now, I'm pretty much in that position now, where I wasn't for many, many years. Yeah, feel
Yeah,
very, very lucky.
it's a wonderful place to be where you can, and I understand that push and pull, that you're just pulled away from the things that really are life-giving and that contribute to your own self and others, and put yourself out there to, really bring this mystery and awe to other people. So it's a really, really beautiful thing. I have to wrap up, unfortunately, but I'm wondering if people are interested in learning more about you, where can they find you? Is there anything that you would like to leave anybody with?
Oh, well, I mean, first and foremost, there's the website, which is, as you said earlier, mythicalireland.com. Mythicalireland.ie will take you there as well. If you're on social media, I have a very, very busy page on Facebook called Mythical Ireland, which is the page. But if you want to sort of participate more, there's also the Mythical Ireland community, which is a group. I'm also on Instagram, X, Threads. And I have a TikTok account, but I'm too old for that stuff. I'd have to get my kids to show me how to make TikTok videos. But also the YouTube channel is a huge resource. And the YouTube channel, which has been up and running since about 2008, I think, has 1,500 videos on it,
Oh,
including
wow.
the previously mentioned 271 episodes of Live Irish Myths. So, like, the whole thing is a tremendous resource. There's a
Right.
huge amount. If you wanted to, you'll. Let's just say, if you haven't seen it before, you could go down very deep rabbit holes with all of that. And then, just to say, if you're on the website, please do subscribe to the new newsletter, the email. And I don't spam. It's only a couple
Yeah.
of times a month usually. So that's important. And the other thing is to support my work, maybe buy some copies of my books or my limited edition prints, which. Or become a patron of Mythical Ireland,
Yeah.
which all helps to allow me to do the work and the research to continue producing the material for the website and for the patrons and for the books and the live streams and the
Yeah.
videos.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today, Anthony. So thank you
Thank
for
you.
everyone
Thanks
for
for having me.
joining us today. Yeah. And to connect further, you can go to the Celtic Feminine podcast.com and email me if you'd like at the Celtic Feminine Podcast at gmail.com. So thank you very much, Anthony. I appreciate it, and connect with
Welcome.
you soon.